Hello and welcome. My name is John August.
My name is Craig Mazin.
And this is episode 639 of Script Notes, a podcast about screenwriting and things that are interesting to screenwriters. Today on the show, why are you or your characters doing what you're doing? We'll look at intrinsic motivation, both on screen and in the brain, because Craig loves neurobiology.
I love it.
No, it's great stuff.
Yep.
We'll also answer a bunch of listener questions. And in our bonus segment for premium members, Craig, will human beings ever leave the solar system?
Yeah, I have an answer for that. We'll save it for the people that paid for it.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah. Craig, happy birthday.
Oh, thank you, John. 53 years old.
Yeah.
Whew.
Nicely done.
Prime number.
Sure. Yeah.
Always like that.
Yeah.
Always enjoy prime number. Still in my early 30s. Still in my early 50s.
Exactly.
Still in my early 50s, hanging on to the early 50s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I know that for people in their 20s, early 50s is hysterical.
Yes.
Oh, congrats on your early 50s, Grandpa. You know, back in the day, John, you were in your early 50s. You were on a glide path to the Golden Watch.
Oh, absolutely.
And, you know, retirement on the golf course and then, you know, rapidly ensuing death, I think. And now it feels like you're just getting started.
You are. Yeah, you're literally just warming up.
Just warming up. The mere presence of statins to control your cholesterol, that alone.
That alone, it's a lot.
My goodness.
So I'm sure you've seen all these memes about like the cast of Cheers and like the actual age of the cast of Cheers when that show started. And you realize like Kelsey Grammer is like 29 or something.
It's Coach is the one that always rattles out because Coach is 56 or something and he looks like he's 80.
Mm-hmm.
And died shortly thereafter, by the way.
Oh.
He didn't live long. I don't think he made it past the second season, which is...
We got Woody Harrelson.
Woody Harrelson. But yeah, Cliff is 35.
Yeah.
I don't know what was going on.
No.
I don't know what was going on.
I've seen explanations that basically a lot of how we perceive people in like older photos and stuff is because people set their clothing style and their hairstyles when they're young and they sort of carry those forward. And then we associate those hairstyles and ways of dressing as being an older person. And so that's why people, when you look at photos of like your parents when they're in high school, like they're like old for sort of their age.
People wanted to be old.
Yeah.
So when you look at the people on Norm, for instance, I don't even know what Norm did for a living. Did they ever even say?
Oh, yeah, they did establish that at some point. So Cliff was the mailman, but...
He was an accountant.
Okay.
Norm was an accountant, and then he loses his job and wackiness ensues. But if you were a 34-year-old accountant, you wore a shirt and a tie and a rumpled jacket, and that was it. People wanted to be grown up.
Yeah.
Remember how much you wanted to be grown up?
Oh, yeah.
And now I feel like no one wants to grow up.
Yeah, I'm thinking about my kid. She does, but also, I don't know, there's also a celebration of youth. I get that. Yeah.
And being current.
Yeah.
You know? So, yeah, people definitely, I think they felt older. Mm-hmm. I think they wanted to be older.
Yeah.
But now, you know, here we are in our early 50s and 20s. You know, still wearing sneakers and jeans.
Yeah.
People just didn't do that.
No.
So, I don't know, maybe we should go for the more rumpled.
That's what we should do.
Middle-aged guy look.
Yeah. I've established this on the show. I intend to live a very, very long life. So I don't want to jinx that by saying it. Yeah, but I'm fine living to 100 or 110.
I'll tell you what, you're going to live as long as you live.
Yeah.
That's the best part.
Mm-hmm.
You just keep going.
Yeah.
And then it stops.
Yeah.
Meh.
Yeah. We've talked about this also on the show. You have no intention of retirement, or does that hold any appeal to you? Or is that like a beach vacation where it doesn't?
It doesn't hold appeal to me currently. In my mind, currently, retirement means failure. Like you failed so bad at what you were doing that an entire industry said, we're done with you.
Yeah.
After all this time, we've collectively decided you should F off.
It's a soft cancellation.
Yeah, soft cancellation. Exactly. So yeah, I could, you know, and then the question is, what would I do?
You'd play a lot of D&D.
I would play a ton of D&D and solve a lot of puzzles, not go to the beach. Hellscape. But yeah, you know, I have a purpose. Mm-hmm. It keeps me going.
Yeah.
There are days I love it so much that even when I absolutely loathe it, what else am I going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're doing your thing.
It's a hard job.
Yeah, it is a hard job.
It's hard. Running
a show.
Yeah.
Keeping the universe going.
Yeah.
Let's do some follow up.
All right.
So many times on the podcast, we've talked about AI, including this experiment we did maybe a year ago, feeding the Script Notes transcripts into a model We found the results that came out of that really disappointing. Ben wrote in with some feedback on that.
He says, I've spent the last decade at Google working on creative and AI, machine learning, then generative AI for video. The models like ChatGPT and Gemini are amazing, but as you found, relatively generic for specific tasks like story analysis and are missing things like discernment or taste. You've also found that narrow models like those trained on your show transcripts are only mediocre. What this perspective is missing is human-in-the-loop training, or HILT, I'm going to say HILT, where someone tells the model that this output is good and this one is bad, on and on and on as the model gets better. The world models won't do this for script analysis because the use case is not important enough. You probably won't do it for the show because it's too time-intensive. But if you did, or someone did, the models would get better quickly and could even be trained on a director's taste or an executive's taste. You could input Denis Villeneuve's body of work and find projects he would like. If you trained it well enough, it could help steer and shape them based in ways he would or might. And these patterns on top of patterns are opening up whole new ways of interrogating storytelling and taste.
Yeah, so Ben is basically collaborating with the board.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's what's happening. I understand that it's been difficult for you guys to assimilate into the Borg collective. However, I've been working hard, and there is a method where we can assimilate you much faster. And then you can assimilate your loved ones much faster. And eventually we'll all live in a cube in space.
It'll be fantastic and great.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about a few things here. First off, this idea of like training on taste, and it's actually been happening in Hollywood forever. And sure. So development executives are like trained on their boss's taste. And so it's not just like, what do we think is going to make a good movie? But like, what do I think my boss will actually like? And what do I know my boss will not like? And so there's specific red flags that you never show those things to your boss. Sure, that may not be a great way to model like what's actually going to be a successful movie, what's going to win the Academy Award. But it's like, what's going to get it through the next step of the process?
Yeah, we're not that. It's funny when Ben used the example of Denis Villeneuve. In my mind, at first, I imagined Denis going, no, this is not possible. No one can understand what I want to do. And then I thought about Denis because he is the most humble man in the world. And I could actually see him going, this makes sense. I believe actually computer could tell me what to do next, maybe better than I could do. Because he's lovely. That's my bad attempt at a Canadian French accent.
Yeah.
I understand what Ben's saying. All I know is that it's all horrifying and I kind of wish it would stop. I really do. I don't like this at all.
Some of what Ben is describing, we actually see in daily practice at Netflix. And so the Netflix algorithm, which is showing you like, this is the thing you might like, it has that human, you know, reinforced training because it's saying like, oh, did you actually watch this whole thing? And so it's taking you having finished watching a thing as a marker that you liked it.
Yeah.
Even if you're not clicking the thumbs up, thumbs down, like, oh, you must like this. We're going to feed you more of this. And it knows it has all its patterns for figuring out like, this is other things you're probably going to enjoy. But on the creator side, it's a little bit more frustrating because they will tell you like, oh, if you don't show this plot point within the first 10 minutes, people are unlikely to finish the show. And like, yeah. And those can be frustrating notes to get from
it
that.
It will be regressive. There was a time before the world of television, for instance, as we know it, where everything was driven by this research nonsense. Mm-hmm. And so every show started to look the same. Yeah. Everybody needed a dog or a funny next door neighbor. And then it was a big challenge for shows that didn't fit that model to even get on the air, much less get watched. But then some of them did and were huge hits, of course.
Yeah.
Because it turns out just because we say we like something doesn't mean that's all we like. Mm-hmm. Everybody likes fried chicken. If a restaurant that was famous for 17 different things decided to only do fried chicken, you'd be like, okay, I guess I'm just if I want for it. But otherwise, no. Then television just opened up into this glorious, we'll make anything, no matter how weird or bizarre. And I don't think AI would have done a very good job of that. Movies have now regressed. So it's sort of flip-flopped. Mm-hmm. So many movies became cookie-cutter nonsense based on research and so forth. But maybe the success of some outliers might be getting us away from this. But nonetheless, my sister, of all people, emailed me the other day, and she was saying, oh, there's somebody that was talking to her about this AI predictive platform that will tell you what shows and movies will be a hit. And I'm just like, it just never ends.
Yeah.
They just keep trying. I don't think that'll ever work.
It won't work. So we lived through a time of classic testing of movies and TV shows. So we'd have test screenings and you'd get numbers like, well, how did you do in your top two boxes? And that was a big predictor of your success. There you were actually showing it to a real audience. And the experience as writers and creators was, I can hear it with an audience. We can actually see and feel how the audience is responding. So sometimes those were useful, much more useful than the numbers were useful. I've also done TV shows where back when they actually had dials. Turning the dial. And the problem is like the dial is not really showing whether you're going to watch that next episode. It's just like, how did I feel in this moment? And like turning those dials is not a good marker. The other big problem with classic research and sort of these AI model research is like they can only account for what's inside their realm of measurability.
Yes.
And so they can say like, oh, did this person complete the show? But like, did they actually like the show or did they hate watch the end of the show?
You don't know. Did they think about the show a week later and change their mind? You don't know.
So all the other outside factors, like, you know, what's happening in popular opinion about it, like is there water cooler talk? What are the critics saying? That's not factored in. And that's a big factor in sort of whether somebody really enjoyed that program and wants to keep watching that show or wants to watch another season.
Yeah,
you don't know.
We're also, what we do in part is designed to surprise.
Yeah.
So if the system is designed to provide you something different, mm-hmm. the most exciting thing is something that is excellent and different.
Yes.
Well, how's a machine supposed to predict excellent and different? Mm. It's hard to account for surprise. Gödel's incompleteness theorem.
Please.
Kurt Gödel, wonderful mathematician, proved that within any closed set of mathematical rules, like our math, there will always be some things that are true that cannot be proven, which is a bit of a mind bender. And he actually proved that. I don't know how, these mathematicians are operating on levels that I simply don't understand.
And thus you need postulates and axioms and other things that are just like fundamental givens.
They prove all of them, actually. Mm, yeah. It's quite remarkable. But you can't create a system that accounts for everything that is true within the system. Mm. There will be some things that are true that cannot be proved. Which is why, for instance, there are things that we know that are true that take years and decades and centuries to prove, like Fermi's paradox and so on. This, I think, is true for entertainment.
Yeah.
There will always be things that will delight people that you cannot account for given the known set of what delights people.
Sure.
So good luck, AI. Why am I taunting AI? I should stop taunting AI.
Let's move on to some more follow-up here. We talked about blueprints and whether blueprints are a good way to describe what we write.
David G. writes, I used to work in construction management, and I would say that it is probably the most similar field to filmmaking than any other. By the time we finished building a building, most of the time the building ended up looking exactly like the blueprint had shown. However, during the building process, we would request something called an RFI, or request for information, to the architect when we got into the field and something didn't work, either because something unforeseen was in the way or for any other reason we couldn't make it work. So while by the end of the project, the structure and idea of the building is like the blueprint was showing, lots of little changes were made to keep the project moving. Sounds like a movie, right?
It does.
Kind of does.
Yeah.
I get RFIs all day long. every prep meeting I have. Sometimes I get an RFI that I've already gotten 12 times. But someone new texts me the RFI and I'm like, oh my God, if one more person asks me this question. Yes, I think as much as we want to metaphorize filmmaking to construction, it's still not great.
Yeah.
It's a tough one. I think sometimes the best metaphor for turning a screenplay into a show or a movie is turning a screenplay into a show or movie. That's what we should be linking back to. It is very within itself.
Yeah. We talked about important movies two episodes ago. We got a lot of feedback on that. Let's start with Brandon. He was talking about games.
Yeah. So Brandon wrote, I work in games, and this is a question that often comes up in that medium, particularly from younger writer and narrative designers. Not just, do I need to have played, you know, whatever game, but do I need to play this entire genre?
Oh my God.
And it's even worse in games than movies because games are such a comparatively huge time suck. It naturally leads to a lot of people with imposter syndrome quietly wondering whether they need to go drop $40 and 60 hours of their personal time or risk being laughed at out of the room. The answer I always give regarding this question is there's no single game you have to play to make a great game of your own, and many of your favorite games were made by people totally ignorant of the genres they wound up defining. However, playing those canon games everyone gushes about can help in two very specific ways. One, it prevents you from reinventing the wheel during that early high-level pre-production phase when you're trying to figure out what stuff you'll need to figure out from scratch versus what someone else has already figured out 20 years ago. And two, it gives you a handy box of touch points and easily communicated shorthand when you're up against a weird problem and need to find a clever solution in a hurry. Writing a 1,500-word design document for a dialogue system takes a lot longer than saying, you know, like Mass Effect and dropping a YouTube link.
You know, those are all great points, Brandon. I'll add a third thing. It keeps you from coming up with a genius idea that then everybody turns, looks at you and says, you mean like the ending of blah-de-blah? But the point is, no, you don't have to do everything. And also, there are other people. It's okay if someone raises their hand and says, oh, I'm so sorry, but that was in blankety blank. And then you're like, oh, okay, damn. Back to the drawing board for me. Among the group, hopefully, people have seen the important things. You know, also, wait 20 years and people will forget the things that everybody knows.
Yeah. Some pros and cons here. I'm thinking of examples of like outsider art where people who came completely outside of the system ended up making amazing things because they just did not know any of the conventions of the genre or sort of what had come before them. And that can be really exciting. But you also have hysterical examples where people just didn't understand what, like, what music was.
Right.
I can't think of the name of the band.
The Shags.
The Shags. Okay, exactly. The Shags.
Yeah, they're incredible.
Yeah.
Frank Zappa called the Shags the best band that ever was.
Yeah. And they had just no sense of what
none
rock and roll music was.
They had no sense of tempo, rhythm, lyrics, melody, instrumentation, or arrangement, coherence. It is a remarkable thing to listen to. And that's why Frank Zappa said, like, if you presumed that what they did intentionally, they would be the most brilliant musicians of all time because no musician could do that naturally. Yeah. But of course, it was also terrible. I think people maybe get a little too obsessed with watching everything, playing everything. What happens is you turn into more of a critic or a repository than you do a creator. And the more stuff that's banging around in your head, the more likely it is that you're going to play this weird, I have to do something no one else has done before game, which will send you down some weird, artificial, over-engineered pathways.
So an argument for sampling and sampling broadly is it helps you figure out what your taste is. Like, what do you actually enjoy? What do you love? And so I would say, like, don't just play these games, but actually figure out, like, what is about this that's working for you? What is not working for you? Why is this a good experience for you? Like, and so not even being so mechanical about, like, what I'm going to take from this, but basically, how is this making me feel? And that applies to games and to movies and to TV shows. What is it about this that you love? And so you can carry that forward rather than the specifics of, like, this plot or this mechanic.
Yeah. And you get a chance maybe to play a game that you enjoy on one level. Let's say, oh, I love the gameplay. Don't like the story. This game, love the story. Game, so boring. What if I took the stuff I liked from this and stuff I liked from this, put my own spin on it? Because, like, when Neil was working on The Last of Us, it's a zombie game, right? There have been a billion zombie games. And it's a third-person shooter. Been a billion third-person shooters, you know? But there had also been games where there were these interesting two-person relationships that weren't really, you know, AAA video games, and there wasn't a lot of action.
Yeah.
Fusing these things together is really interesting. Jonathan Blow, who has made some incredible indie games.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Braid and other things.
Braid is a great example of somebody saying, what if you took a very simple platformer, added a little quirky backwards time unroll element, but then tell a story that is so bizarre and deep and rich and weird and kind of Vonnegut-ish, and you get something remarkable like Braid.
But in case of Blow and Braid, you have to have played enough of those games to understand, like, how platformers work and what the conventions are in order to be able to subvert them.
And so you follow your love, right? So like, if you have this real deep love for a certain genre, what do you do now to kind of do your own weird spin on it? So Rian Johnson made Brick. He loves noir films. I'm sure he watched a gazillion of them.
Yeah.
And then thought, I also love John Hughes movies at high school. Now let me see about smushing my loves together. But he understood the rules. Kevin Williamson, clearly so deeply immersed in the world of classic 80s VHS slasher movies.
Yeah.
How do you take all that knowledge and remix it into something that feels current and interesting? So there are people, yeah, I think follow your nose and you'll find your genre. You don't have to play everything. That'd be crazy.
That actually ties very well into our next question, our next follow up here.
Yeah, Paris writes, looking through your list of important movies, I realized I'm totally screwed. I'm 24 years old. I was born in 2000 and I wasn't exposed to many films growing up. I began trying to catch up in my 20s, but there's so much I haven't seen. It's overwhelming. I looked through the list and made a highlighted version of my own films, and I've seen 85 out of the 400. If the 1970s were on there, I'd be toast. Any advice where to start? I don't want my lack of cinema knowledge to affect my writing.
Yeah, so Paris sent through their list of, like, highlighted list of things that they've missed, and there's really great films among their list of what they've missed. My advice to Paris would be to start in the 2010s, pick three movies you're curious about, watch them, and then go back a decade, and then go back a decade. Let it be fun homework. Don't feel like this is a thing you have to do. Just, like, really follow your curiosity down this rabbit hole and see what it is that you like. But I don't think if Paris were to take, I'm going to spend the next 2 years and every day watch a movie off this list, I don't know that's necessarily the best use of their time.
No. And it will also, again, turn you into a movie critic.
Yeah.
You'll become a culture hoarder as opposed to somebody that's watching things that they love, because the entire exercise will feel forced and artificial. One method, Paris, may be to pick a movie from a director that has a bunch of movies on this list. So Scorsese probably has a bunch on this list, Soderbergh, Coppola. Watch one of their movies, see if you like it. If you like it, keep watching their movies. Mm-hmm. A little bit like playing every track on an album.
Yeah.
So if you started with Do the Right Thing, for instance, well, if you love Do the Right Thing, check out some more Spike Lee movies. If you watch Raging Bull and you love it, it's time to switch over to Goodfellas or Mean Streets or King of Comedy. Same with the Coen brothers. It might be better to kind of just find the filmmakers you love and follow them. And then every now and then, just stick in a random one. The other option is you can just say, I'm going to watch one of these dramas. Mm-hmm. Every month, I'm going to watch four movies. Okay, just four. Each week, I pick a different genre. Drama, comedy, thriller, horror, whatever it is. Just mix it up. Keep it light. It's not homework. You'll be fine.
Yeah. I would also say movies can be social experiences. See if you have friends or somebody else who wants to sort of get in this movie club with you. Because then you can have a discussion about what you saw.
Absolutely. One of my great joys now that I'm old.
53
is I get to show movies, especially from the 90s, which were
great movies. Great year.
Allie, who's in her 20s, or to Bella, who's just in her 20s. And I showed Bella Matrix for the first time. I showed Allie Godfather for the first time. That's so much fun. Yeah. The other thing is, like, find somebody older who is like, okay, I think you will love this. Like, let them be your AI who knows you, thinks of your taste, and goes, I think we'll love this. And most importantly, I always say to anybody I'm showing a movie to, you get to pull the ripcord whenever you want.
Yeah.
If you're bored, I don't care if it's The Godfather, whatever. If you're bored, give it 30 minutes. Mm-hmm. You're bored after 30 minutes, next movie, or we'll go have a sandwich. It's fine. It shouldn't feel like you're eating gravel.
Yeah, 100%. Last little bit of follow-up on here from Willie.
Willie in Dublin writes, I want to push back on the idea of movies that you absolutely need to see or ones that you can ignore. For sure, you can be at a disadvantage in a professional situation if you haven't seen canonical works, but I think that people who have different experiences can make valuable contributions to the creative process, as long as there is a lingua franca for collaboration. What's the point if everyone thinks the same?
Multiple logical leaps inside of Willie's comment.
Yeah, I would say.
So many.
Yeah, a little straw manning.
Yeah, just a goalpost shifting. First of all, you say, I want to push back on the idea of movies that you absolutely need to see or ones that you can ignore. So you mean to say you want to push back on the idea that you contradict yourself within that first statement. So which one are you pushing back against? Because if there are movies that you can't ignore, that means you absolutely need to see them. And if there are movies that you don't absolutely need to see, then there are movies that you can't ignore.
Yeah. I think Willie's pushing back against this idea of canonical lists. And these are really arbitrary lists of 100 movies that a lot of people seem to like and a lot of people talk about as the movies of that decade.
Sure.
But
nobody is suggesting that if you don't see those things, you have, quote, no valuable contribution to the creative process. Nor do these movies contribute to a lingua franca for collaboration. Collaboration is an entirely different thing.
Yeah.
And certainly, I don't think if everybody sits down and is forced as an entry point to watch the same 100 movies, there is no chance that that means that they will now, quote, think the same.
Mm-hmm.
No. They'll argue about them all.
But to go with the other illogical extreme, it's like you have the example of the Shags. And like, if you are the screenwriter who is the Shags, who has basically seen no other movies and has no understanding of how movies work, you're going to write something that's going to be perhaps fascinating on a, you know, a textual level, but it's not going to be a movie.
Yeah, I'm not sure that you would be writing a movie.
No.
I mean, the Shags are such an incredible outlier because they didn't want to do it either. Their dad made them do it. So they didn't know. They had neither the desire, I guess we're going to be talking about motivations shortly. They had no motivation to do what they were doing other than their father being like, you can become the next Partridge Family. And they just tried their best. Yeah.
Good stuff. All right, let's get to our main topic here. So on April 6th, the New York Times connections puzzle had the words desire, drive, resolve, and will, which were the four that lined up. And the category put for that was intrinsic motivators, which is nice. A good way of looping those together.
Yep.
And so we talked a lot on the podcast about motivation, about goals and needs and wants. Episode 569, we talked about inspiration versus motivation and touched on some of this, but I thought we'd dig in a little bit deeper on intrinsic motivation, which is basically what is, you know, driving a person internally to do a thing versus the situation. So it's not about external forces like deadlines or ticking clocks or circumstances. It's about something inside them that's driving the character to do a thing.
They have a list of things that they require something to meet to be considered alive.
Mm-hmm.
It needs to reproduce.
Yep.
It needs to ingest.
Yeah.
And possibly excrete. But my favorite one is it needs to show irritability.
Interesting.
And irritability is reaction to stimulus. Mm-hmm. We have, as living creatures, an innate irritability. Things bother us and create a want. But the interesting thing about humans, and certainly when we're writing characters, these irritabilities can sometimes be philosophical in nature. People have been asking forever, what's the whole point of this? That makes you irritable.
Mm-hmm.
Not knowing things, curiosity, is a great one. So what is the intrinsic motivator for Hercule Poirot?
Yeah.
He wants to know. He could, somebody could say he's really committed to justice. I don't think so.
No.
He doesn't, like, in his spare time, it's not like he's working down at the courts as a prosecutor. He's just curious.
Yeah.
Curiosity alone is a spectacular intrinsic motivator.
And that's the thing they can actually study in animals. You think like, oh, animals are just responding to stimulus. So they're trying to seek pleasure and avoid pain. But like they will actually go into like an electrified area because they're just curious what's in there. And so like, you know, certain animals will do these kinds of things. And so, you know, we talk on the show sometimes about negative intrinsic motivators, so fear, shame, jealousy, mm-hmm. self-doubt. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about sort of the positive versions of those, like what the actual drives, because I've been watching shows and movies recently where I feel like after 2 hours or 8 hours, I still couldn't really tell you what is motivating them internally, what are the positive internal intrinsic motivators are, like what's their desire, drive, resolve. If it was a musical, I couldn't sketch out their I Want song. It's like there kind of isn't one in there. They can feel a little bit lifeless because as humans, I know they should have something like that driving them.
Yes. When this happens, we tend to refer to the characters as flat or thin, two-dimensional. And it's because the characters are only apparently motivated by circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
But ideally, circumstance is the second thing that happens. The first thing that happens before the show or movie even starts is they already are irritable about something.
Mm-hmm.
Something is missing. Something must be known. Something must be uncovered. Are you a BBC Sherlock fan by any chance?
I did. I watched all that.
Love that show. And one of the things that I love about it is that when Sherlock Holmes doesn't have a case, he starts to go insane.
Mm-hmm.
He wants to smoke. He wants to shoot heroin. He loses it. He becomes violent and irritable. And that precedes any circumstance that comes along. So sometimes we end up with these characters who are defined simply by their job, their present circumstance. Then a new circumstance happens and they have a new job to do. But who are they?
Yeah.
What happens when this job ends? And if I'm supposed to stop caring about them when the job ends, why would I care about them now while the job is still going on?
Yeah. And that is the real frustration. And it could be that well, the story, but really is the writer and sort of the how the story is being structured. It's just not given any opportunity to actually explore those things. So like that character may actually have those things, but we as an audience aren't getting to see any chance of that. And because they're generally not musical, so that there's not a chance for them to like fully articulate what it is they're doing, or having some other character they can talk to about the thing. We need to find ways to structure and expose what is that internal drive that's pushing them to a thing.
Yes. Now, there may be moments where you show a circumstance and that circumstance becomes the internal drive, but it's soon. You don't want to wait around forever. And that circumstance that creates the internal drive must be clearly separate from the new circumstance that is the main body of the plot.
Exactly.
So I can't tell you much about the character of Joel in The Last of Us leading up to his daughter's death. He works in construction. He's a contractor. He seems all right. I don't know his internal states.
No.
I don't know what his intrinsic motivation would be. She dies. 20 years later, that is now I understand what his intrinsic motivation is in general,
yeah.
Whether it's to avoid or whatever. Then the new circumstance begins.
Yeah.
But it is within the context of that prior irritability. So as much as possible, when you're thinking about you at home, when you're thinking about writing the story and the characters, you need to know what the problem is before the problem shows up.
Yeah. There's generally either a lack or some other object goal that's out there that's a little bit more vague, but a thing that they're trying to do. There was a New York Times story this last week about a guy who was really good at quiz shows and quiz competitions, and how he went from little small ones to bigger ones and ultimately ended up like applying to a specific university in the UK so he could get into the university quiz challenge system. But then I got there and found like, oh, his teammates actually weren't any good. So he pulled out because he only has one shot to do this, and they had to sort of reframe everything around him. He was really driven, and it's the kind of character who, if we were doing a How Would This Be a Movie, you love, because you can definitely see like why he's trying to do what he's trying to do. It's not some external thing that's pushing him. He clearly has a drive to enter these challenges, succeed, and to win. He needs this thing.
But of course, I want to know why, right? So like, what is the thing that I can connect to that is universal, even though his expression of that thing is unique? I want what's underlying it to be anything but unique.
Absolutely. And so that goes back to sort of where we first meet this character and how he first gets introduced to this world of quiz competitions. And so it was probably that moment at which he first said like, oh, I know all the answers to this thing. And like suddenly he was better than everyone else around him. And so it's that desire to sort of excel, to be seen as being better than everyone else. But also there's an internal state where he needs to see himself as being so good at this.
And I love those things. Yeah. So I, like just about everybody, love Queen's Gambit.
Yeah.
And Scott Frank is as good as anybody at this. And my favorite episode of Queen's Gambit was the first one. Mm-hmm. First episodes are notoriously difficult. But what was so beautiful about the first episode was that he took the time, lots of time, to tell us all about this person before the obsession began. And before the plot began to create irritability. She was lonely. She was abandoned. She was in pain. She was self-medicating. She was desperate for something to be good at, something that made her feel good. And there were two things that made her feel good, drugs and chess. And watching her begin to fall deeply into both of those was such a gorgeous way of showing how sometimes these things that we think of as just awesome, like being the best quiz solver or being a chess master, are in themselves forms of self-management for conditions that are common to us all.
Yeah. A movie I loved this last year was Naiad. It's a story of Diana Naiad and her quest to be able to swim from Cuba to the United States. And in that, yes, there are external things that she can gain by doing this, but clearly it's an internal drive. She has this unique obsession with being able to do this and be able to prove to herself that she can do this thing. And that's what's pushing it through the whole movie. And, you know, we see the consequences on everybody else around her, and yet we're still rooting for her because we can see, we don't want to be in the water there with her, but we can see why she wants to do it.
Yes, we understand the underpinning. If all Moby Dick were about was whale hunting, no one would care.
No.
But it's really important to create that in essential irritability, to find the grain of sand under someone's skin. It's usually something that they are not born with, but it is the result of some circumstance. If it's innate from birth, that means there was nothing to create it. Mm-hmm. You want to have something in the environment that causes a disruption that is specific to somebody before you then cause a really big disruption to them.
Yeah. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes to this article, this review in the National Library of Medicine that's really talking through intrinsic versus extrinsic motivators. And sort of they actually did scientific studies on sort of how these drives actually function in the brain and in actual human beings. And sort of talks through the different theories that sort of built up over time for how this all worked. And when you actually put people in labs and MRIs and you're sort of monitoring how they're doing things, you get the sense that like what is happening internally versus externally are related, but there are distinct things that you can see there. And what it really comes down to is the importance of agency, the ability of a person to say like, I am choosing to do this thing. And so we see that in real life where you have a kid who loves to do a thing. And then the minute you sort of talk to them about the thing they'd love to do, they don't love to do it anymore because it's no longer their unique thing.
Yeah.
Also, it's the ability to envision an outcome and plan the steps towards it are crucial for intrinsic motivation versus extrinsic motivation.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point. The idea that you need to see an outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Your characters must, we talk about a goal.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times people think too much in terms of the external nature of that goal. But part of what we all do as humans is envision success.
Mm-hmm.
And envisioning success is rarely about the circumstance. It's about the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to win because winning is good. We want to win because winning feels good. Why? What is it doing for you? What negative feeling is it taking away? What negative thought is it replacing or contradicting? What is it proving?
Yeah.
How is it going to remove your irritability and make you feel good? And to me, envisioning an outcome is entirely about envisioning a feeling that you desperately want.
Yeah. It's not just about where you're going to get to, but how it's going to feel when you get to that place.
All about feeling.
So they outline what they call a Rubicon model, which is five steps, which is whenever a character is facing, or whenever a real person is facing a thing, there is a pre-decisional deliberation, which is basically where you're sitting, you're thinking about what your options are. You have intention formation, which is you're planning. It's the anticipation. It's thinking about how you're going to do this thing. Volitional action, which means agency. You're making a choice. You're doing this thing because you want to do it. You are achieving that outcome. You're sort of consuming it. And crucially, then you're also evaluating it. And we've talked about this on the podcast. It's not scoring the touchdown. It's, you know, getting the kiss from your wife afterwards. Like that's the real achievement.
Yes. It's the relationship at the end. So when you look at these five things, what they remind me of most immediately mm-hmm. is Dungeons and Dragons.
Oh, yeah.
So right now you're DMing a campaign. Yeah. I'm playing. Woo. And inevitably there's a circumstance where it's like, well, there's a room in there mm-hmm. and we know there's a bad guy and we know there's another bad guy. Let's come up with a plan. And notoriously, plans go awry in D&D. It's sort of designed that way because if your plans always worked, what fun would that be? It would just be like, oh, we're the dream team in the Olympics. Ha ha, we win. But we do all of these things. There's so much deliberation, prediction, planning. Then we do the actions according to the things we want to achieve. There is an outcome achievement, which hopefully is a victory. And then there's a postmortem about how we did it, how we could have done better, how we did better than we thought. But here's the crazy part. It's not even real.
Mm.
And it's so satisfying.
Yeah.
Because as humans, we can model real outcomes and get the same hit off of them. That's why we like movies and TV. They are modeled outcomes where we watch other people achieving a feeling we want to feel, and we get a little whiff of their crack hit,
mm-hmm.
and that's worth the subscription to, you know, Max or whatever.
Yeah.
That's what all of these things are. That's what I love about what we do. We are creating situations for people where they can sit back and watch somebody else go through all this hard work and suffering and then get the win. In real life, suffering sucks.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the win, when you get there, does not feel at all like you thought it would feel. In fact, there is a shocking emptiness that can occur sometimes when you get there and you think, I was meant to feel all of this.
Yeah.
I don't feel any of it. Now what do I do?
Yeah.
That's always fun.
And so I would say part of what was leading this segment was some recent movies and some TV shows I was watching, I felt like weren't working on these levels because it was just like, well, you were killing the monsters. You did all the step threes. You did all the, you took all the actions.
Yes.
But I didn't have that lead in terms of, like, of the options. So it just felt like you were on rails the whole time you were doing this thing. And I didn't get the reward afterwards because I couldn't see, like, well, did we actually do the thing we wanted to do? I didn't feel a sense of victory.
You didn't feel a sense of victory because probably in this circumstance, the characters couldn't have really felt the sense of victory. They could have just realized it. If you don't have that pre-existing irritability, that thing that we can connect to, and you're put into a situation where you have to do this impossible thing, mm-hmm. or else a lot of people will die. Okay, I'll do it. I did it. Good. That's kind of what you end up with.
Yeah.
Good work. Mm-hmm. You roll credits. But that's not what we're there for. We're there for understanding something deeper was satisfied. And if we don't have that in place before the person shows up with the job offer, then we're just not going to be as engaged.
Yeah. The study outlines intrinsic rewards versus extrinsic rewards. And so whatever you do and whatever you achieve should have a mix of the two of them. So intrinsic rewards, agency and autonomy. So mm-hmm. a sense of control, a sense of achievement, enjoyment and interest that you actually enjoy, like the characters inside this world enjoy doing this thing that piques their interest, and novelty, which is basically this was a new thing for them that they sort of were able to conquer. The extrinsic rewards are things we're always used to. So food, social status, money, a sense of safety, those things we can sort of expect. But it's those intrinsic rewards, I think so often we are not rewarding enough in our characters. We're not sort of giving them a sense of this. And so like they'll survive this thing, but they haven't had a good time. We haven't seen them enjoy it.
Yeah. Have you seen Game Night?
I love Game Night.
Yeah, it's so Game Night's wonderful. And it's a great example of this. They do such a good job of setting these characters up as people that love games. Mm. They love winning.
Yeah.
It excites them. It excites them, and it also brings them together. It's the thing mm-hmm. that kind of makes them love each other is that they're really good at unraveling puzzles, answering questions, and winning a game. And that's enough irritability for us.
Yeah.
Because when you jump into the future, that's a little wobbly now. And then this new thing happens, and we get to watch their enjoyment of it, and they fall back in love with each other again.
Yeah.
The characters need to get a hit off of this stuff. If it's just a grim slog, then, well, how am I supposed to enjoy this? If you can't enjoy any of this, and it's gauged in subtleties, if you have a very grumpy character, and I've been writing one of those for a while now, sometimes just the tiniest smile tells us a million things, but we need to know it's happening or else it just doesn't matter what you do. Grumpy's going to be grumpy, and that's not going to make us happy.
Yeah. Last little takeaways here. I would say if you're looking at your story and you're worried that we're not getting a sense of what their intrinsic motivations are they curious? Are they out there? Are they looking through various options? Are they foraging? Or are they doing what you're telling them they need to do? Are they being forced into a situation by your plot?
That would be bad.
That would be bad.
Yeah. So passive characters, which generally no one likes, are not merely passive because they don't do stuff and stuff happens to them. Sometimes they're passive because they're doing stuff, but they only have one choice. Mm-hmm. If there's no choosing, their actions feel passive.
Yeah.
Because what else are they going to do?
Yeah. I guarantee you, like you could say, like, well, this story, like the characters has no choice but be passive. Like they don't have any choices. They don't have any options. They're like, they're in prison, literally. And there are great prison stories. And the reason why those great prison stories are great prison stories is within their narrow set of options, they are making real choices and they're taking agency.
That's right. If you end up in a situation where someone's like, we need you to do the following impossible thing. Mm. There's one way to do it. This is how you do it. And you say, got it. And then you do it.
Yeah.
Now, even this little thing in Star Wars, like there's only one way to blow this thing up. You got to shoot this thing down a hole. And that's the only way to do it. That is what he does. But before he does it, he turns off his targeting computer and uses the Force. He makes a choice.
Yeah.
And that choice is why that works. Otherwise, think of how terrible that would have been.
Bad sequence.
They're like, you have to do this thing. We showed it to you on a computer graphic. I did it.
Yeah.
Great.
All the other complications you could have thrown at them. It's like, oh, but now this thing is in your way.
Who cares?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. The only way to win this is to hit a hole in one. Okay, I hit a hole in one. Yay. Whatever. Where's Tin Cup? Have you seen Tin Cup?
I've seen Tin Cup.
Oh my God. One of my favorite endings. Have you seen Tin Cup?
No. Ron Shelton.
Ron Shelton, great movie. So he's got this thing where he's stubborn. He's very good, but he's his own worst enemy as a golfer. And he tries to hit too hard. He hits too long. And people keep telling him, you got to lay up, right? Meaning instead of going for, you know, two under par, just hit the ball short and then hit it again and you'll get one under par. It's better for you. It's smarter. And he ends up in this situation where he's going to win this tournament. He's bounced back. Everyone can't believe it. And he has a chance, though, to just make the most awesome shot ever over this water trap. And he has to hit the ball super far to do it. And they're like, don't do it. Just like, it could lay up or it'll cost you the tournament. And he's like, no, I'm going for it. And you're like, it's going to happen. And he hits that ball and it goes right in the water. And then he's like, I'm doing it again. And he hits the ball again and it goes in the water and hits the ball again and goes in the water. And then there's this, and people are like, well, okay, so he's blown up his career, yeah, the tournament, his life. He's stubborn. He's learned nothing. And he does it again and he hits the ball and it goes all the way over the water. And I think it gets in the hole. I can't remember. But the point is it gets over the water.
Yeah.
And it's an impossible thing. And people go crazy. Like, he did it. And you understood then just doing the thing you were supposed mm-hmm. to do. You do have, you always have a choice.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, Ron Shelton is just brilliant at that.
Excellent. So as we wrap this up, I'll put a link in the show notes to this NIH study. Also, the story of Brendan Blackwell was the Quiz Bowl champ, which is a great story. So all the UK listeners are saying, well, of course, Brendan Blackwell. Like, everyone knows that.
But, everyone knows Brendan Blackwell.
But not here
Brandon,
in the US.
Brandon. Brandon Blackwell.
Yeah. An American.
Oh, bloody American.
Bloody American.
Coming over here winning our pub quizzes.
Let's do some listener questions.
Proud Dad writes, my daughter is a high school senior, and she was accepted to both the USC screenwriting program and Princeton. Mm. In our 30-minute morning drives to her high school, we listened to Script Notes faithfully, and it's still one of our favorite memories. So thank you for being in our carpool for so many mornings. This might not be a fair question, because we know Craig doesn't think school has anything to do with being a screenwriter.
Correct.
And we know that John did the MFA program at USC, but we would love your thoughts as if you were weighing the pros and cons with your daughters. Long term, my daughter would love to work in television, but she's very passionate about playwriting and is torn between either USC, where industry contacts and writer's room opportunities are common, and Princeton, where she can learn from Pulitzer Prize winning authors and playwrights. We'd love to hear your thoughts.
We might be too late here, huh?
It could be.
Yeah. Well, so complicated also is that I went to Princeton. So now you're dealing with both of our alma maters.
Yeah.
John, what is your, first of all, congrats.
Congrats.
Thanks for listening.
Both good schools.
What do you think, John?
I think it's what she, well, obviously it's what she, whatever she wants. So like she has to make the decision between these two places. If she really believes that she wants to work in television, then USC will be great for that because she'll get that sort of television experience. But that, all that said, I think undergrad is really about sort of learning how to learn and learning how to do all the other stuff that's interesting and exciting to you. It's all the classes that are not about film and television and playwriting. And that's going to matter a lot more. So she's not going to go wrong either place.
No, I agree. I don't know how this ended here, but my guess is that she should go to the place that she feels the most excited about going to. Mm-hmm. She should go to the place that makes her feel good. Mm-hmm. She should envision her goals and see if where they fit better. Princeton does have a remarkable creative writing program, and they've always had remarkable teachers there, like great Toni Morrison taught there, John McPhee, Joyce Carol Oates. And so you certainly would learn from remarkable people. That said, I'm not sure that makes you a good writer. I think that just makes you somebody that sat in a room listening to great writers talk. There's only one person that can make her succeed at what she wants, if what she wants continues to be what she currently wants, because that changes.
Yeah.
And that's her. And it doesn't matter where she goes.
No.
It truly does not matter where she goes. If she's good at doing this, she'll be fine coming out of Princeton. She'll be fine coming out of USC. There are loads of people who graduate from USC, Stark, the whole thing, mm-hmm. who just don't really make it. There are loads of people who do what you and I do, who didn't go to any film school or went to schools that weren't known for going to film schools. It's a real chaotic mess out there, and it comes down to the individual, to the outlier. She should just go to the place she actually wants to be. And you know what? Maybe you meet to future spouse. You never know.
Yeah.
Do people even do spouses anymore? Are we just old because we're married?
Yeah. You met your wife at Princeton.
I did. I met my wife at Princeton. And that's sort of the thing that I got out of Princeton, to be honest. It didn't help me with my career.
Yeah.
It certainly wasn't a great freshman year experience. We all know that. I don't have this thing. A lot of people that go to Princeton are super into that, you know, like being alums and everything. And I don't care. You know, yeah. I mean, I went there, but it was a school. But I did meet my wife, and I also learned things there that I carried through. The classes I took that I was not expecting to take were the best ones. Mm-hmm. Best class I ever took in my life, Princeton University, animal behavior. Learned more about humanity and animal behavior class than anywhere else. So that's the fun part, is that throw your plans out the door, open yourself up to new experiences, and see what happens. Because you might walk out of there wanting to be a doctor.
So I was a journalism major at Drake University undergrad, and then I applied to and got into USC for film school. And I will say that graduate film school is nice because you get people there who actually have some, they're not all just like random freshmen doing stuff. And like USC, she got into the film program as a freshman, she'd be around people who want to make films and television, which is great.
Yeah.
But they're also a ways away from doing that. And the nice thing about a grad program is like, you're closer to doing the real thing. So you're able to get internships and sort of really be out there in the world doing stuff.
There is that. No question. There's also, though, a very strange thing about the culture of aspirants. Mm-hmm. There's a weird thing in the air, this kind of choking ambition and striving and wanting and people jockeying. And sometimes you can get dismayed by who's getting rewarded and who isn't. And you just think, this is not fair. That person's bad. They're pretentious. They're a fraud. No one can see it except for me. And eventually people figure it out. But when you're around a lot of people trying to do the same thing, it can be kind of gross. I do remember that feeling early on in my career where it just seemed like everybody was like rats clawing through a maze to find one small piece of cheese. And occasionally there was like a rat on top of you and you're like, oh, bah. And then if you heard about a rat getting a piece of cheese, you felt despair. Like, I thought the cheese was a lie. I thought this was all just, oh my God.
I also felt a fair amount of imposter syndrome. Like I did not belong to be in the STAR program when I got there. Mm. And like, that's the thing you need to get through too. And you know, the nice thing about going into someplace outside of one of those film programs is like, you're not going to be surrounded by quite that much of the culture. So.
Yeah, I think allowing yourself to develop as an individual and being a little more pure about it is probably a good thing. On the other hand, yeah, there are opportunities that you can get going to places that have these connections. Yeah. But I don't know. That's the thing. You and I are pretty good examples because you did one of those choices. Mm-hmm. I did the other choice. We're both doing the same job.
Yeah.
On the same podcast.
Crazy that.
In our 50s.
Yeah. We're both 53 years old.
50 frickin' three.
Let's answer one more question here, one from Jonathan.
Jonathan writes, how much should the writer consider the trailer when writing the script? I'm thinking in terms of early reveals that tie into the premise and would likely be shown in the trailer to advertise the film, but could still be a surprise to the reader or anyone who sees it without having seen a preview. So I'm reminded of taking my friend to see The Sixth Sense and how shocked he was at the "I see dead people" line, not just the ending.
I argue that you should consider the trailer as you're writing. Think about sort of like, how would you actually present this movie to an audience while knowing that you are going to have zero control over that as the screenwriter. So, it's, you know, for movies I've done, I've written trailers and sometimes those have shot, or teasers and sometimes those have shot, but rarely have I had real direct control over that, including when certain crucial story pieces are revealed.
Yeah, sort of a nice thing is that I do get quite a bit of influence on the TV side over the marketing material. So I do work closely with them on that. I agree with you. So I think, Jonathan, we're both saying, yeah, you should consider the trailer. And there are really two moments in the trailer that I try and think about. One is, how does it start? And one is, how does it end? What is my last shot of the trailer? What is my last moment of the trailer? Is there a mic drop? Is there a holy crap? Is there something, a single beautiful line? Is there a question? But the opening of the trailer is just as important. What do I see? What do I hear? What sets the tone? The middle stuff of the trailer, you can imagine, will be some simple storytelling and some cool shots and some laughs and some action and surprise. Blah. But it doesn't mean you should sit down and try to write one of those moments. More like if you put yourself in the mindset, it might help you get there. Or as you're weighing possibilities, if one of them pops out and you think, well, that'd actually be great in a trailer. I don't know if it'd be like super great in the show or the movie, but in a trailer it'd be great. Write it in so you have it. You could even say this is for marketing. I've done this before, although I do try to avoid doing the thing where you, I don't think I have where you put stuff in a trailer that you don't put in the show. I don't think I've done that. You know, sometimes they'll do that. I think if it's worth going in the trailer, it should be in the show is my feeling, or the movie.
Yeah, I would agree. The reason why you need to think of the trailer is like the trailer is essentially your elevator pitch. Like, why does this movie exist is really kind of the trailer. And so if you cannot tell your story somehow visually in that little bit, there's probably something that's not quite working with your story. That said, like, Go was an impossible thing to sort of cut a trailer for. Like, it's hard to sell the premise of Go, at least the story premise, but you could sort of show what it felt like. Either you're communicating a story or you're communicating a vibe, a feel.
Yeah. If you watch trailers for Coen Brothers films, that's almost always what you get, which is this kind of absurdist, weird feeling that's more than story. It's more a sense of the madness that's inside of the movies they make, which are, you know, pretty much always beautiful and brilliant.
Yeah. All right. It's time for our One Cool Things. My One Cool Thing is actually two episodes of Search Engine, this podcast by PJ Vogt. And it's looking at why there are so many illegal weed stores in New York City, because like all these storefronts are selling weed illegally. And he's going into sort of what the history was there and sort of why it got to be this way. And so he has to go back to California's pot legalization system and sort of like what went wrong in California and sort of all the things they were trying to fix when they legalized weed in New York and how it all kind of didn't turn out the way they wanted it to turn out. So in attempting to fix the mistakes of California, they made new mistakes, which has led to this proliferation of illegal weed stores and made it very hard to open the legal ones.
John, how many weed stores do you think there are in Vancouver? Just take a guess.
Oh, the answer is either going to be zero or...
It's definitely not zero.
All right.
It's legal to sell.
Okay. Hundreds.
93 million. There are 93 million weed stores in Vancouver. There are weed stores inside of weed stores in Vancouver. Vancouver smells like rain and weed. It is insane. Also, just side note, I'm not answering this question as much as I'm just now rambling about weed. Have we talked about the drivers in Los Angeles lately? Okay, so when I moved to Los Angeles, I remember thinking, oh my God, everyone's insane. Because I think they were on coke. I think all the drivers on the road were on coke. People were switching lanes constantly for no reason, which feels very cocaine-y to me. Now... I think everyone's just edibled up. They are slow.
Yeah.
They are slow. Like the light changes green and it's sort of like, all right, sure, I guess I'll go now. I preferred the cocaine drivers. I really did.
The other thing I have noticed over the course of my 30 years driving in Los Angeles is when you move to Los Angeles, you had to learn that in order to take that left-hand turn, you're going to need to go into the intersection
and turn left on a red.
Yeah, which sounds impossible.
Three cars get to go. Yeah, that's the deal.
That's the deal. And I think decade by decade, people have gotten more nervous and more nervous about doing that.
They're not nervous.
They're stoned.
They're stoned. They're just like, oh man, I missed the light.
Yeah.
It's no worries. Hey, guess what? Light's going to come around again, man. It's all good. I just had five peach strawberry gummies. This is me being, this is 53-year-old guy going on about goddamn stoners. I just want them to be on cocaine so that they'll go through the light. I need to go places. Anyway, I will check this out. It's so silly. This weed thing is so silly that New York has illegal weed stores. It's like hearing, I don't know, that in 20 years ago, someone was like, oh my God, did you hear that in, Toledo, they have illegal cheese stores. You're like, why did they need, what? Just sell cheese. It's fine. Everybody else is. Yeah, it's over. It's over, New York. Just let them sell it. Have we talked about Shogun?
We've not talked about Shogun.
That's my one cool thing this week. So Shogun, the miniseries on FX, Hulu, Disney+. I think it's technically, it's FX. I want to give the mayor of television, John Landgraf, credit here. It is FX, which is also Hulu and also Disney+. I watch it through Disney+. Anyway, I'm really enjoying it. Shogun is one of my favorite novels of all time. I've read that novel multiple times and I rarely do that. I was deeply influenced by the 1980 miniseries. If I learned a lot about storytelling from that, so I watched the miniseries. I was 9 or 10, and absolutely blew me away. And for 1980, it was remarkable. It was on ABC, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I would say half of the dialogue was in Japanese, subtitled, which just didn't happen.
Yeah.
The Japanese people were played by Japanese people, mm-hmm. which also often didn't happen. And Toshirô Mifune, the Laurence Olivier of Japan, who starred in all those wonderful Kurosawa movies, played Lord Torunaga, which was remarkable. And Richard Chamberlain.
Oh, yeah.
Played the love interest. Yeah. Because he loved the ladies. LOL. And I was obsessed. And so then I went and read the book. And I got even more obsessed because the book was just full of all these other details. And you also realize what they kind of mushed, you know, to put on in a miniseries on network television. So here comes Shogun, written, created by Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo. Have we ever had Justin on the show?
I think Justin's been on the show. Justin's a friend, yeah.
So he and Rachel, who is his wife, or rather, I should say, he is her husband. Mm-hmm. They belong to each other. They've created the show, and it's excellent. It is doing a much better job than the 1980 miniseries of being authentic to the time period. And I love the attention to detail. You know, I'm a detail nut. And it's so clear how they've gone into every little corner, made sure everything looked right. They're telling the story in a really interesting and beautiful way. But also, maybe this is the coolest part of my one cool thing this week. It releases an episode every week.
Yeah.
It comes out on Tuesdays. I look forward to Tuesdays.
Yeah.
It's almost over, but each Tuesday, I'm like, oh, it's coming, it's coming. That's how you're supposed to do it.
Yeah.
I don't understand. For the life of me, I still cannot understand why anyone would make a huge, like, three-body problem on Netflix.
Yeah, I want it was a right? three-body problem.
Massive show, and they're like, here's all of it.
Yeah, it makes the footprint so much smaller. Well,
they should have do it one a week. I just don't know. Game of Thrones worked great. They all want to have their next Game of Thrones. They got the Game of Thrones, guys, and just forgot the one thing about the Game of Thrones, which is you put out one episode a week. People look forward to it. They watch it together. They talk about it together. People write recap essays. Anyway, so congrats to Justin and Rachel, but also congrats to FX for doing it correctly. This is the way to do it, and they're going to win everything.
Yeah. Well, it's also a strange Emmy season this year because so many things were not. You're not eligible for an Emmy this year.
No, because we're not on,
not on the
cycle. Well, the Emmy cycle is so the award cycle got so thrown off by the strikes.
Yeah.
So next week I'm going to the WGA Awards for a show that aired over a year ago.
Yeah, I'll see you there. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic! What will you be wearing, John?
I'm debating between
who will you be wearing.
So it's black tie, but not everyone actually wears black tie. Are you wearing a suit or a tux?
I'm gonna go tux.
Great.
I'm gonna go tux because how often do you get to wear a tux? Yeah, I've got it.
Yeah. It's also an afternoon, which I think is great.
Yeah, so you can leave and go about your day. So you're going suit or tux?
I think I'm going to go tux.
You're going to go tux. Why not? Go tux. Go tux. It's at the Palladium.
Yeah.
Great.
Sure.
I'll see you there. The WGA award show is particularly amusing for the following reasons. One, not on television.
Yeah.
No one cares.
Yeah.
Like even fewer people care than normal. Two is my favorite part. Because the WGA is, and I will say this forever, stupidly divided into two unions, the WGA West and the WGA East. And because the WGA East really is like, we're also going to have our own same time. Stupid. Like we don't have planes. They run a separate award show for the same categories simultaneously, not with different nominees, same nominees.
Yeah.
But they need to have their own award show running at the same time. But because they can't exactly run at the same time, because it's not televised, it starts to wobble out of sync a bit, which means inevitably you get a text.
Congratulations.
Or
sorry.
Oh, that sucks. And you're like, wait, oh, they haven't even said my category. I'm leaving. And that's the other thing about the WGA Awards, because it's not televised. People just start leaving. By the time you get to the last award, there's like the janitors. It's like, you guys got 5 minutes. We got a wedding coming in. I think this one will actually be quite nice because it's the first post-strike award show.
Yeah, it's also outside of the award season, which I think is actually kind of great.
Right. It means nothing.
Yeah.
It predicts nothing.
It predicts nothing. No, it's just right. It's already a very loose award show. So I think it should be a loose and fun.
Yes. Yes. It will be pretty relaxed.
All right. That is our show for this week. Scriptness is produced by Drew Marquardt. Yeah. Edited by Matthew Cilelli. Yeah. Outro this week is by Ben Singer. If you have an outro, you can send us a link to ask@johnaugust.com. That's also the place where you can send questions. You'll find the show notes for this episode and all episodes at johnaugust.com. It's where you'll find transcripts and sign up for a weekly newsletter called Interesting, which has lots of links to things about writing. We have t-shirts and hoodies that are great. You'll find them at Cotton Bureau. You can sign up to become a premium member at scriptnotes.net, where you get all the back episodes and bonus segments, like the one we're about to record on humans leaving the solar system.
Ooh.
Craig, happy birthday once again.
Oh, thank you, John.